event was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued, following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low-paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on. And so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, mayor of London, certain government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada.
We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that involved the truth-telling of the residential school system several years ago, and it came out with over 200 recommendations for Canada as a whole to take action to reconcile and to remedy a lot of these issues that are contributing to these violations. And it's very, very slow going.
Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against Indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report.
Canada has failed to remedy its treatment against Indigenous peoples in this country for hundreds of years. It's the ongoing assault against our people in this country. It's the legacy of colonialism and Indian Act policies that are oppressive against our people, the remnants of the residential school legacy that left our people very broken.
Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide.
So in regards to the water crisis that we have, at any time in Canada, there's approximately 100 First Nations across the country that have lack of access to clean drinking water. It's so bad that just a few weeks ago, an entire First Nation community in Northern Ontario was evacuated.
The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019. The Canadian government has also been criticised for interfering in the affairs of other countries. Canada has consistently meddled in the affairs of Venezuela. It has imposed several rounds of sanctions and temporarily suspended its diplomatic operations in Caracas. In June, Canada announced sanctions against Nicaragua for its alleged human rights violations. This interventionist policy has been in line with Washington's policy against leftist governments in Latin America. The Canadian government is also under pressure to end its $15 billion arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada has yet to suspend existing arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, despite policy guidelines urging close control over exports of military equipment to countries with a record of human rights violations.
And Canada should not just say, well, I'm sorry, there's commercial considerations and there's the fight against terrorism by Saudi Arabia. What has happened in Yemen is terrible. in terms of human rights. And the fact that Canada would pay a penalty is not relevant when it comes to human rights. And no, Canada is one of the only countries now, apart from the United States, that hasn't done anything. Germany has suspended.
Canada is yet to release the findings of its 2018 review of military export permits to the kingdom. Canada is also under fire to hold Myanmar accountable for the genocide of Rohingya Muslims.
In a digital world where messages can be sent in an instant, it's been interesting to note just who sent their messages of congratulations to President-elect Joe Biden, and who didn't. For many world leaders, the dutiful message was sent in quick time, but for others, many question the rationale behind the delay. One country that has made their feelings clear from the start is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who from the offset have stated that the eventual outcome would not change Iranian foreign policy. But one message that did slip through is the Iranian president's thoughts as to the so-called JCPOA and potential of the US returning to the table. With the JCPOA being ratified by the United Nations, the deal has been written into law and is hence why President Rouhani of Iran has warned that the Americans must learn from the mistakes of their past and insists that Washington use the election of Joe Biden as president to follow a legal and legitimate path back to its international commitments. But for one of the United States' closest allies, it seems that the arrival of Joe Biden as president could spell a huge change in policy, with the Israeli regime quickly stating that Biden being able to re-enter the deal with Iran would be no easy feat. However, is this just Israel scaremongering Biden into avoiding building closer ties with Iran, which will ultimately alienate the Netanyahu and Tel Aviv regime? In fact, so worried is the Israeli regime that one Knesset lawmaker has stated that Biden's likely policies with Iran could lead to the Israeli regime entering a physical conflict with Iran over the notion of nuclear issues. However, Iran has always stated that any nuclear program that it pursues is solely intended for civilian purposes. But with West Asia being so full of fallout left behind by the Trump government, how then will Joe Biden approach the area when he comes into office? And will US foreign policy under Biden truly be designed to bridge the gaps haphazardly created by Trump?
I think what we will see regarding the Middle East is he will want to rejoin the JCPOA and become part of that again. However, the Iranian government has rightly said that the U.S. would need to make some compensation for the damage that has done in these last 2 years since Trump pulled out of it. So that will not be a smoother transition, a smoother re-entry to the JCPOA as Biden might like to think.
Much like the Israeli regime realizing the election of Joe Biden will be a game changer for them, so too, it seems, does the UK realize that the United States may see a very different relationship with Britain when Biden comes into office, meaning that ties with Britain and the US may no longer be such a special relationship. Already, Joe Biden has warned Britain that it will be placed at the back of the queue when it comes to the job list that he's set up. Already, Biden has to somehow reunite the people of his own country before worrying about a dividing Europe, meaning that Britain may find itself in trouble come January. With Boris Johnson already struggling to secure a deal with the EU and now facing the prospect of having nothing to grasp onto in the US, could the election of Biden spell bad news for Boris? For one, Biden is already fuming at the so-called internal market bill, which could upset the Good Friday Agreement, a topic close to the heart of the Catholic and Irish descendant president-elect Joe Biden. But Johnson's already starting to suffer defeats at home, as the House of Lords have already waved away his internal market bill, much to his embarrassment. It seems that the British have also fallen on bad times with the Brexit deal so far failing, and Biden unlikely to prop up the blundering mistakes of Boris Johnson, which could leave the British very much isolated and very much in economic and political pain. But with many nations around the world planning and preparing for a post-Trump era and promises of a new start with Joe Biden, is it simply just too soon to decide just how each nation wishes to interact with the US, reminding us all not to count our chickens before they hatch?
Yes, it is early for leaders of other countries to be approaching Biden, the president-elect, and talking about trade deals and so on. However, I think people are so anxious to deal with someone who will be at least reasonable that they are reaching out now, even though it is early, and Biden will not be inaugurated for another 2.5 months.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more than 70 million votes.
There's growing political division in the United States to a level that hasn't been seen in a really long time. You have crumbling infrastructure across the country. You have rising unemployment. They're talking about a second and third lockdown in the United States. The economic situation is really dire. And so two wings of the ruling parties in the United States are fighting against each other.
Many observers had anticipated that the outcome of the election would be disappointing for either side if the other secured victory. But the tight race between the two candidates shows how polarized the American public has become. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on. And this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
He has challenged the results in several states, including Arizona, where the president's campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. This is despite that a stream of heads of state have already congratulated Biden on his election victory. Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election results and the possibility of fraud are adding fuel to the already smoldering fire burning in the U.S. society. Trump supporters, some carrying weapons, have rallied in several U.S. cities protesting the results and echoing the president's allegations of fraud, saying the election was stolen.
I think what this election has shown above all else is that the U.S. claim of being legitimate and democratic and having free, fair, and quick elections is collapsing. Nobody believes that myth anymore. And the fact that a country like Bolivia, for example, had faster, more efficient elections even after a coup than the United States just goes to show that.
President-elect Joe Biden seems to have recognized the threat. In his victory speech, he pledged to heal what he called a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now, let's give each other a chance.
But how long will it take until he manages to fulfill his promise, if at all?
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajeem. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Sayyid Mustafa. I'm originally from New Zealand, and I've been living here in Iran now for about 3 years, and I've been studying here in the Hawzas. Yeah. Today with me in the studio are two very lovely brothers, and I would like them to introduce themselves as well. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting. This is Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and I'm living here for the last 8 years. Right now, studying, doing my PhD in economics, Islamic economics, and right now in front of you.
MashaAllah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi from Sweden, and I am studying a PhD in Islamic mysticism.
The topic that we have today for you is a very interesting topic, in my view, and that is about, you know, we live in a world where everyone just likes to criticize, you know, everything. They want to give you feedback about everything, right? And when it comes to religion, you see the same thing. You see people asking a lot of questions. Many times they're criticizing, you know, Islam, or not only Islam, all religions, you know. And there's so much talk about reforming religion, right? You hear all these people saying we need to reform Islam, we need to reform the Quran, we need to reform
modernize
this.
Islam.
Huh?
Modernize Islam.
We need to modernize Islam, right? So
we'll shun away from the word.
Are we allowed? Can we criticize religion? You know, are we allowed to criticize religion? And can we reform religion? Is this something that's possible?
First of all, there are two different things here. Can we criticize religion? Yes. Can we reform Islam? That goes back to modernism, and that has to do with modern, what we call modern Islam.
Now, when you say we can criticize religion, right. What do you mean? How can we criticize religion?
First of all, as a convert, I can tell you that the first step towards yaqeen, towards certainty, is to be in doubt. When you have doubts and you start to go for the truth, as you mentioned in every top, in every program, that which is a very good sentence, you start to have doubts. When you have doubts, if you do not criticize, if you do not search for the truth, if you do not go and ask, how would you reach certainty? So the way to certainty, the way to that peak, is through doubt and through criticizing, through asking. All right, so that is something very positive. If you have something to criticize, or you are dealing with something mentally, you want to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. That does not go hand in hand with your mind, with your intellect. You want to solve it. Now you can come and reach the truth, or you might not reach the truth, depending on your background and your set of mind. Now we have a lot of modern Muslims, for example, who believe in things that are considered immorality. From the Islamic perspective. Now that is something that they have to deal with. They have not reached that level where they can say, okay, this is wrong according to this and that. But then you have other people who say, no, I have reached Islam because of criticizing my own religion. So when we start to scrutinize our own religion, when we start to point finger towards ourselves, then we see some development. Then we see an increase in knowledge, and so on and so forth.
Now, if you can criticize religion, someone might say, you can also then change it, right? If you can criticize something, you're not accepting something, you're questioning it, that means that you want to change it, right? Or you, and that's what a lot of people are doing, right? What do you think of that?
Well, as brother just said, like, we can criticize. I don't agree with the point. Because in the explanation, when we are mentioning that, if you bring up a doubt and then you try to find out the answer, this is something else. Criticism is basically condemning something.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Because when we use the word criticize, basically you're condemning something. And then when you condemn this, obviously you have proofs, or maybe it's not according to your mentality or the way you want to live or your beliefs. Because, you know, when we are growing up from our childhood, we have different people around us. Mm. And they make us our beliefs. Our beliefs are depending on the people who are surrounding us. So criticizing religion, it depends. There are obviously, we need to see the boundaries that are within those.
I would argue against that. That sounds very tough.
Yeah, that's fine.
So but criticizing means condemning?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
Would you say that, you know...
You know,
you
generally, when we talk about criticizing, when we say you can criticize, it's basically condemning. It's not the way to general. I'm talking about the general people.
I gotta check the dictionary about that.
I'm talking about the general people, general public. They think like this.
No, but we were once upon a time among the general public.
There isn't in the Quran. We have the verses and the riwayats. It also talks about that to do not blindly follow something.
Right.
That is fine, but it does not mean to criticize.
What does it mean?
To do not follow blindly means if you have a belief, you need to go and you need to research. You need to basically think about it. You need to learn about it. For example,
is a dimension of that. Not follow your religion blindly. There is a part of it which has to do with criticism. No. Not only doing research.
You can't really necessarily translate
criticism to condemnation.
I think what you guys are trying to say is that, you know, you can't necessarily criticize religion itself, but you can criticize our understanding of religion, right? How we understand it. Yeah, if we misunderstood it, then we need to
correct
that.
The religion itself cannot be criticized. Yes, the understanding, the ideologies that are given, the explanation that are given by the scholars, the way they interpret it, yes, we can criticize them. We can obviously have an argument on it. But religion itself, like, for example, we are Muslims. Being a Muslim, we cannot criticize Islam. When we're talking about criticizing the religion, it means you're criticizing Islam. And, for example, if I can go through the synonyms of the word criticize, I can find a fault or disapprove and condemn, slate, it's informal word. These are the basic.
So you mentioned now four different words.
I know. Yes.
One of them was condemnation. Just to make it very clear, two others were fault and finding what?
Find fault in the religion.
Right. Okay. That's completely
the religion itself. The problem is the argument is the religion itself, the Islam itself, cannot be criticized.
Right. But what
because it's a complete set. It's been sent by someone who is the sole owner of this, you can say, the rules or Islam. Okay? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala do not have any fault. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a perfect being. He's a sole entity. It's us who are the possible being, and we have faults in ourselves. We cannot criticize Islam itself in its true meaning, but the interpretations that we have from the other scholars within the Islam, for example, do this, do that, and this is, for example, they're interpreting a verse in another way. Yes, we can criticize or we can argue on that. But religion itself being Islam, we cannot criticize it.
Right. So I think what... Right.
Because if you
I don't really understand what you mean with that sentence, criticizing Islam as a religion in itself.
So here, let me try and maybe clarify that, right?
It's not that clear for me.
So if we say that if something is perfect, right, well, you can't really come and change or criticize it. However, we do have many, I would say, misunderstandings within religion, right? We have many wrong ideologies that have come up or many wrong. Those are the things that I think...
Even that are from the people, not from Allah.
Right, but I think we should differentiate between two perspectives. One is from the divine. Islam is the perfect religion. But then what I was zooming on was from the perspective of the common layman. All right, me as an individual, I want to scrutinize and find the truth. I want to ask. I want to do my research. Then you should be allowed to criticize the religion itself and also some parts. Now, as a Muslim, you have entered religion, but then you have question marks about, for example, some jurisprudent issues, some fiqh issues.
Right. So you're equating
to criticize there too. So it's in a vertical line with different strengths and weaknesses.
I think the issue is that you're equating criticizing to questioning, right? I think those are two different things, right? Questioning something asking question is different from actually criticize. Normally means like you're saying to someone.
It's harsher.
No, it means like you need to correct this aspect. That's normally what criticism means, right? It means like, if I'm saying, for example...
But I mean both aspects. I mean both of those definitions that you said.
You're not talking about the divine itself.
No, the divine is set. It's fixed. Okay, that is perfect.
Well, first of all, I would say
but
why...
But me, as a human being who wants to reach that divine, who wants to reach that truth, who wants to reach the ultimate peak, I have to be able to ask. That is one dimension of it. Or even higher, or harsher criticize
within Islam.
Because
let
we
me give
have
you
the
some
most firmest Muslims today who were among those who criticized the most. All right.
Well, first of all,
I have some of the examples. For example, like we have in the morning prayer, we pray 2 rakat prayer. Someone can criticize. Is someone allowed to criticize this?
No,
while
that is
you pray two.
Right, that is set.
Not four.
That is set.
Yeah.
Right.
Or that's ta'abudi. That's right. Being submissive. Because there is a trial for you. Allah wants, sometimes He orders you to do something which is not according to my feelings, which is not according to my ease. I feel comfort praying, for example, 4 rakat prayer in the morning. Yeah.
No, that is a set
not doing
principle.
Two. But the answer is, that is ta'abudi, that is submissive. There is a trial for you that Allah wants to see you, whether you are submissive to Allah or not. There are many rulings like this. Islam itself is a perfect set of religion when we talk about Islam. Within the interpretations, when it comes to, for example, the jurisprudence discussions where the people has done it, not the divine discussion. Allah, it's not from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's about the ulama or the scholars. Yes, you might disagree with someone and then you can maybe criticize or re-argue on that.
Right. Now, Sayyid,
and
he went
I
into the Sharia perspective.
Yeah.
That is correct. The Sharia perspective. There are some, the frame is there from the Sharia perspective. The 2 rak'ats and so on and so forth. So homosexuality, for example, is forbidden.
Right.
That is not something that we as a Muslim can change, even if some modern Muslims try to.
Right.
But that is unchangeable. But then you have the topic of rights. You got women rights, animal rights, whatever. You can add that. You can add more rights to it. So the limit in the Quran and the Sunnah and the Ahadith is there. The limit of this right for this individual or this and that is there. But you can add more. That is a new look, a new outlook
why do you think people,
the principles cannot be changed?
Well, why do you think people criticize things to begin with? Why do people criticize religion to begin with, right? I mean, for example, do you see people criticizing, you know, mountains or, you know, like nature, trees, things like that, right?
Right.
You don't really see people criticizing, trying to reform those things. Why are people criticizing religion? What is it, you know, that's the motivation or cause behind it?
Well, that's because we have religion up to the amount of salt in the food. I just gave this example before. Like, you know, when we cook food, just to make it tasty, we add some salt.
Isn't this a hadith as well?
Yes, it is a hadith that the people there, they just try to give a color of religion to their daily life, whereas the religion should be the main part, and then their social, or you can say the other activities, or the things that they follow should be according to the religious perspective. Because, you know, in the chapter 30, verse 30, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, I have created all the humans on the same fitrah, like on my own fitrah. He has created us all equal, okay? And when He has created us in such a way, then He expects us to go to the perfection in the same way. It's equal. Like, there's a discussion of the woman and the man equality or not. Allah has created us equally. And this equally means that you can reach to the perfection on the equal basis.
When it comes to Sharia and reform, as I said, the set is there. There are some frames. There are some fixed frames that you cannot change. Those principles, you cannot compromise on those principles. So you will not have a reformed Islam in that perspective. The principles are set. But those modern Muslims who try to reform Islam when it comes to the principles and modernize Islam, they have a deformed Islam, not a reformed Islam. So to give an example, within the Sharia, the frame is set, a minimum of rights are given, but some argue that within that frame you can add more rights or abolish some rules depending on the intellect of the society that you are living in. But the reverse is not allowed. You're not allowed to breach the boundaries of the minimum rights which are in the script or in the Noble Quran and the Ahadith.
All right, thank you, brothers, for your insight. That was very interesting. And just to summarize, I would say, you know, I would say people criticize religion, it's because of their lack of understanding of things, right? That's when you criticize or you want to reform something, especially something that's we believe to be perfect, That's when you want to criticize and change it, right? When you don't understand it, man. Anyway, so that's all the time we have for this episode. Please continue listening. Continue seeking the truth and answers. Fi amanillah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump is reportedly planning to hold campaign-style rallies in support of his push to dispute the outcome of November 3rd presidential race. Those rallies, per reporting from Axios, are set to include Trump reading off names from the newspaper obituaries, alleging that those individuals had voted in the election even though they were dead. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, writer. This article is published under the heading, Trump Plans Obituary Readings at Rallies to Support Claims of Voter Fraud. Here's the details of this article. U.S. President Donald Trump is reportedly planning to hold campaign-style rallies in support of his push to dispute the outcome of November 3rd elections. Those rallies, per reporting from Axios, are set to include Trump reading off names from newspaper obituaries, alleging that those individuals had voted in the election even though they were dead. Trump's attempts to suggest that diseased individuals participated in the election may be accepted by his most ardent supporters. One claim that 21,000 dead individuals in Pennsylvania had voted spread on social media late last week. Another claim shared by Donald Trump Jr. purported that a man in Michigan who shared the same name as his deceased father had voted on his behalf. That claim was also exaggerated as it was a clerical error that had mixed up the names of the father and son. Another claim that spread on Twitter last week insisted that thousands of deceased individuals in Michigan had taken part in that state's election. A CNN analysis of a sample of 50 names on that list found that, indeed, some of those included were deceased. Opinions within the White House appear to be mixed over whether Trump should continue his fight against the electoral outcome or concede the defeat. Media organizations have said Kushner is fully behind Trump's efforts to contest the results alongside Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and campaign advisor, Jason Miller. Biden was announced by the media the winner of 2020 presidential election after a week of vote counting showed that he had pulled ahead of Trump in several key states.
After Pennsylvania was announced as a win for Biden, the Associated Press made the call that the former vice president had won the race, breaching the 270 electoral college vote threshold in order to beat Trump. Team Trump is now ready to announce specific recount teams in key states, and it plans to hold a series of Trump rallies focused on litigation and voter fraud in the United States of America. Trump includes in different states, including in Georgia, which Doug Collins, the outgoing congressman who lost to Senator Kelly Loeffler in a special election to fill former Senator Johnny Isakson's seat, will be leading the campaign's recount efforts. The team has also redeployed 92 staffers from Florida to Georgia, doubling its group on the ground. In Arizona, Corey Longfor, former counsel for Trump's 2016 transition, will serve as lead attorney. In Pennsylvania, Porter Wright's Ron Hicks is heading up the legal effort. And nationwide, they are assembling additional surrogates and lawyers. We want to make sure we have an adequate supply of manpower on the ground for man-to-man combat, one advisor said. The group is also staffing a campaign-style media operation. The team led by Trump Communications Director Tim Martow is now a surrogate messaging center. It will pump out regular press briefings, releases on legal action, and obviously things like talking points and booking people strategically on television, one advisor said. Team is also planning to make a big play to raise money for their legal defense fund. Trump's former legal team includes 2020 campaign manager Bill Stephen, lawyer Justin Clark, and senior advisors Jason Miller and David Bussey. Representatives Jim Jordan and Scott Perry, as well as former White House Chief of Staff Rince Priebus, are also advising. Trump's team claims there is no daylight between them and the White House. Chiefly senior advisor Jared Kushner and current chief of staff Mark Meadows.
I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become both more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the world's walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.